Okay, it's charged in orbital order in half doped manganites, and also I'll look at the higher doped, mainly at the higher doped manganites. Maybe it's done here. It's done by myself with Ginyard Kalyulin in Stuttgart, Max Planck Institute, and Daniel. And this is actually appearing next week in PRL, and the other paper appeared a few months ago. Electron-doped manganites, well, you heard about the neodymium, strontium, praseodymium, strontium, calcium, samarium, we have a whole family. And because X is larger than one-half, we call them electron-doped. They're, of course, perovskites. I remind you that the calcium end member is an antiferromagnetic insulator. And they are theoretically, I would say, easier than the whole doped compounds. I'll explain that later. Let's say phase diagram, experimental, or as seen by a theorist. Here I have doping, and here I have different compounds. And in red, you see the ferromagnetic phase, which you can see for the neodymium strontium and praseodymium strontium, for instance, until about X equal 0.5. At X equal 0.5, you have the CE phase, antiferromagnetic CE phase, which this morning you heard a lot about. And if you go on in doping, you find an A phase, antiferromagnetic A phase, and also antiferromagnetic C phase in this neodymium strontium compound. In the calcium samarium, you have, it's not clear, but you have an antiferromagnetic phase here, very close to one, which is A or C. That's not very well established. What is this?
But maybe also ferro. Because there is no net moment.
What do you call it? What about the rare earth bones don't play any role?
No. No, for no.
Okay.
Well, it depends for what, but for the physics I will discuss, no. So what is this A and C? And just to remind you, ferromagnetic, of course, antiferromagnetic G-type, two sublattices, every spin has six neighboring spins with antiparallel, of the antiparallel type. A-type, which are ferromagnetic planes coupled antiferromagnetically. C-type, ferromagnetic lines coupled antiferromagnetically. And of course, you can have all kind of mixtures, counted types, and what you can have more. And the question I want to address is, can these anisotropic spin structures be explained by the double exchange mechanism, which we believe is very important in the manganites? The CE phase, also to remind you, at low temperature, you have it's insulating, and magnetic order looks like this zigzag chain. So it's a ferromagnetic chain, zigzagging, neighbored by another zigzag chain, but with the spins in the opposite direction. And along the C-axis, there's exactly another chain, antiferromagnetically coupled, lying on top of the red. So the red chain is surrounded by four blue chains. Yes. What you see, what's seen experimentally as well, is a charge order in the CE type at this half-doped system, and the charges seem to accumulate here, where I plotted the green dots. And the question, of course, is, well, why is this phase stable at all? Why is it insulating? Why does it choose such a particular kind of spin order? Well, very basic things. Can also skip it. Well, the crystal fields split the EG and the T2G. T2G are localized, form a core spin. EG form the conduction spins. There's a large Hausdorff coupling between the conduction spins and the core spins. So if I have the calcium end member, I have D3. If I start to put electrons, I go toward lanthanum, and I start with an EG0. So here I have weak correlations, just because the density of EG electrons is low. On the other side, I start with EG1, and I start to dope holes. So I have a very strongly correlated system. And that's what I meant before, why the electron-doped members here are easier. They are in first order, say, uncorrelated. So we can do something with band theory or side binding.
So the
about the same order of magnitude.
Order.
I think. Well, the Hopping integral is something like 0.4 electron volt, so it's 6 times the Hopping integral as the bandwidth, I think. Yeah. Okay. So, and I think the Jahn-Teller energy is some. An electron volt, less half an electron volt, or?
Yeah, it's about half an electron volt.
Okay, so, but.
The quarter kilocell, I mean, they're correlated, but how important are the correlations?
No, that's definitely important because it's not insulator. Insulator, even about insulator.
U is about, say, 8 electron volts. Well. I mean, it's much larger than the Jahn-Teller energy. But okay, that's say the difficult limit, I would say. Double exchange model, well, probably you know there is the Hund-Schultz couple. I think you calculated also that it's 4. Yeah, that's from calculation. Yeah. EG electrons hopping around here, and their hopping integrals are fully determined by symmetry, by the symmetry of the EG wave functions. And unfortunately, that's not very transparent, but it's well known how these hopping integrals look like. Then we have the Hund-Schultz coupling between the local spin, large S here, the T2G spin, and the conduction band, EG, electrons. And finally here, we have a coupling between the T2G spins that want to be, of course, antiferromagnetic because of super exchange. So what you can do with this very simple Hamiltonian is, okay, you say 3/2 is almost infinity, so we take this as a classical spin, the T2G. The Hund-Schultz coupling is larger than the Hopping integral, which is certainly the case. I get a classical model where the only parameters I have is the angles between the spins on different sides, and the Hopping integral now is reduced or related to these angles. So it's very simple. And in a very crude picture, what happens is the following. If the T2G spins are parallel, this is very nice for the EG electron because it can hop around without losing any energy or paying any energy. But the super exchange is frustrated. The T2Gs want to be anti-parallel. That's bad for magnetic energy. If the spins are anti-parallel, it's good for magnetic energy, but very bad for the EG electron, which classically cannot hop anymore to its neighboring side. So there is a competition between magnetic and kinetic energy, and if you put in the right Hopping integrals, there you can optimize, or you can find the ground state easily. And it turns out that you get for low doping, okay, the famous spin-counted ground state, which is not stable. So this is all doping. Intermediate doping, you get the ferromagnetic ground state, but for a very large doping, you get the A and the C type antiferromagnetic state. Just because of this competition between kinetic and magnetic energy, or double exchange and super exchange, if you want. So this is what we did some time ago. And here, as a function of, I remind you, electron doping, so this would be the calcium end member here. And here, the only parameter I have in my model, that's T over J. This is the phase diagram. Ferromagnetic phase, A-type phase, C-type phase, and here, very, very low electron doping, another A-type. So if I would say, okay, my parameter here, T over J, is about 4, I can draw this phase diagram, or sequence of phases, better to say, where I go from ferromagnetic to A to C, and again to A. So, well, at least qualitatively, it looks like... This is with the double. It's exactly like Anderson DeGene calculation, but only with the degeneracy of the orbitals. That's the only difference.
I know you answered this question, but the TIAs depend on which orbital you have
in
this time.
Exactly.
Do you have electron pulse unit here?
Yeah. Well. Let's say yes, but I can put 4 electrons on my sides. I mean, it's an uncorrelated system.
So then you can extend, we'll have the same thing from 1.5 to 1?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't you maybe not be A-type?
Calcium?
G-type.
Oh, calcium, the G-type, yeah. Yeah.
G-type, okay.
This line here is G. I didn't draw it. I mean, I have no.
Is there a special argument for the C-type?
Yeah, well, there is. What is C-type? It's ferromagnetic, or chains that are ferromagnetic coupled antiferromagnetically. So electrons move effectively in one dimension because of double exchange. Yeah? That's not so good because they prefer to move in three dimensions. On the other side, every... electron, or every T to G spin has 4 anti-parallel T to G spins around it. So that's pretty good.
But the point is that we can make use of shape orbitals. So
yeah.
We can make a band out of that orbital, then they actually hop only along C. And then they have to make only chain thermogenic, and they don't care about interacting with each other.
These orbitals occupied. So electrons move effectively here, and if there was no orbital degeneracy, this would really reduce your bandwidth a lot. Yeah? It would be from 3 to 1 dimension. But now, because I can occupy these orbitals, which are pointing so much to each other, I say compensate more. I compensate for my lowering of the dimensionality.
So is that also put into the model then?
It comes out of the model. I mean, I put in the there's nothing to put in. Yeah.
Orbital ordering does
it comes out. Orbital polarization. Orbital polarization.
What is the band?
Yeah. Bands. I mean, it's a band picture.
It's a band. But it's band because it's not
band. If you want to call this orbit, these are the occupied orbitals. If you want to call that orbital order, that's fine.
Yes,
there is a whole calculation, like mean field calculation, which comes from Furukawa, but it's not Furukawa. There is this color picture. The same model or not?
Sorry.
This is Furukawa. They have
Nagao.
No.
The same model, or it also means field.
Okay, they take very similar, but they take the on-site Coulomb interaction into account in a mean field fashion, in a Hartree-Fock fashion, and look, what they do is go from 0 to 1, yeah, try to cover the whole phase diagram. What we found out is that you really have to do a careful job here. And you have one-dimensional bands. You cannot just, and you have to take enough k points. You have to. There are cusps in your densities of states. You really have to be careful.
Is
and calculate total energy.
Richer structure. You find richer structure.
Yeah. Yes. Well, in this whole, yeah, in the, yeah. But essentially, there's only C, A, and Ferro. But yeah. And G.
But I
didn't
expect that there is a lot of center states somehow.
Well, there are. It's really to be
already fully polarized in planes or in
things,
but really not much place of center.
Well, that's not completely. Of course, states, this is not an A-type state. This is a G-type counted in an A-type fashion. It's not that you put a few electrons and the system completely changes its symmetry. I mean, it's still G-type, but it starts to count in the planes.
Yeah.
So.
But you said that was that you were saying it was unstable.
That A type.
Yeah. As to phase separation, yeah. Yeah. No, it is. Yeah. Or at least I couldn't find it.
So you found this
There is, yes, there is phase separation. There is phase separation. I think the rule is very simple. If you theoretically find a counted state, it's unstable. No reason, no doubt.
Well, not always. Almost always.
Yeah, okay. Let's say rule of thumb is not stable. I mean, you have to do real efforts to make it stable. And in general, I mean the okay. Let me just go on to the CE type, which is maybe even more interesting. Yes. But it's very weak. Yes. So let's say. Exactly. Let me see. If my bandwidth goes up, the ferro gets more stable.
Ferro is more stable. So the top one, right? The
top one. Large bandwidth system.
Large bandwidth system. Oh, large bandwidth.
Yes. Okay, now we look in the same spirit now at the CE type. And we can say, okay, let's first just put in the CE-type magnetic structure and look what happens. And let's just take a orbital basis which we like because it's the easiest one. Okay, so I put my orbitals here along this zigzag chain where I choose this directed orbital 3x squared minus r squared on these, say, bridge sides, and on the corner sides, I have two orbitals, one, the one sticking out, is 3z squared minus r squared, and the x squared minus y squared here. This is just a basis, but it's the simplest one you can choose. Why? Because the other orbital here, the orthogonal one, doesn't have any overlap either to the left or to the right, if you think about it by parity, exactly, by symmetry, completely by symmetry. So one orbital is out. I can throw it away. And that's nice. Now, electrons can only move in the chain because of double exchange. So it's effectively one-dimensional. And now let us look at the topology of the hopping. Just follow an electron that goes from one corner to from one bridge side to another bridge side. It starts in this definite orbital here. It can hop to either one of these orbitals on the corner, this one or this one, with different amplitudes given by symmetry, and hop back to, or hop to this orbital here, which is where there is only one, again with different amplitudes. These amplitudes, of course, are related. And the funny thing is that if the electron here passes a corner, it gets a phase, it acquires a phase. This is exactly the phase of the x squared minus y squared wave function, of course, which points in one direction as a minus, the other one as a plus. So if you look at this, you say, well, this reminds me of something that reminds me of a Parnell's problem. Yeah? Let me do a very simple-minded picture of this and say, okay, here I'm hopping T1 plus T2, here I'm hopping T1 minus T2. Exactly Parnell's. So I will have an insulator here, a bent insulator. Of course, life is not as simple like this because you cannot add these hopping integrals, but just to give you an idea. So hand waving, what happens is you have something like in the Parnell's problem, and you're exactly at half filling, or let's say one electron per two sides. So you get a band gap, one. Then second, here on these corner sides, you have two orbitals that are partially occupied.
So when you do this, approximately there is one electron every other side.
Yes.
And put them not in the corner, but in the middle.
I let them just move. I let them move in the bands that are given. Yeah, it's a metallic state. But because of the sign here, it will be a band insulator. I will show it later. But let me just do the hand-waving things first. Okay, you will see it will be a band insulator. Then on the corners, two orbitals are part of the time occupied. Now I switch on the on-site Coulomb interaction. Electrons don't want to be correlated. They want to be uncorrelated. So they will move to the uncorrelated side, which are here the bridge sides. Because the orthogonal orbital was always empty anyway. There is no electron that can move in or out of there. So the on-site Coulomb interaction will move the charge from the corners to the bridge sides. And this will give me charge ordering immediately. So the on-site Coulomb interaction gives you charge ordering, not the nearest neighbor Coulomb interaction, which might also help, which might also do things. But the on-site Coulomb interaction itself, because of the orbital, the occupied orbitals, the orbital order, will give me also charge order. Okay. Hand waving. From this, let's say, it's a zero temperature picture.
The organization energy is electron of the order of the hopping energy. So the state configuration ought to be stable at temperatures which are pretty high in terms of the order of T2 or T1 or something like that.
Well, it depends to what you compare. But I will come back to the stability of just the very last transparency on the stability of this. But
it's not a recoupling kind of stability
or a change in the number, but it is proportional to TC. Okay, maybe you discuss it later. So I just make my hand-waving argument, which is written here, corner sides, two orbitals partially occupied, bridge side, only one orbital. On the corner, I have a Coulomb interaction effectively, and this will push my charge to the bridge. What is the dispersion for U equals zero of this chain that I have drawn before? Well, it's exactly as I already told you. It's here I have the dispersion for a single chain, and now for the chain with these particular orbitals. You see now I have three bands where the lower band here is split up by a non-dispersing band with an energy delta, and delta is exactly the hopping integral T in this case, and there's another band higher up also with the gap of delta.
But you know, even in terms of interference, we have a stadium because of periodicity.
It's
like no. There is no charge. No, because the way he has automated in hopping integral, he has chosen d square orbital here and the other two. So don't you increase the periodicity by 9?
No, because I choose a basis. I can choose any basis.
So both orbitals are there at every point.
And this is independent of any basis I choose. It's a physical observable. I don't put in anything. Or nature puts it in, if you want. Yeah.
You chose the circular orbital at one side.
Mm-hmm.
And every side, yeah.
Yeah.
You chose both of them.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you have neglected the circular and circular orbital in the intermediate.
But it's zero by symmetry. It drops out by symmetry, as you said. I can also take it into account and make the proper rotation. I can take on every side these two orbitals in this way, get the same result.
So once it drops out by symmetry, then you know, in a sense, the periodicity is broken.
Yes.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's broken from the very beginning. From the beginning, thereby.
Why do you say it dropped out by symmetry?
So one overlaps and one doesn't, I see. Yeah, let's say x squared minus y squared orbital.
Yeah.
But
oh, right, I see. By forming the bonding orbital, the other one is transverse, and so the lobes can flow.
Exactly.
So it's a non-bonding orbital on that side.
Yes.
And you're saying that in the band structure, you just leave that at whatever energy
yeah.
is that, and then you just put in the hopping integral for the other one. That's,
yeah.
That's all you're doing.
Yeah. So in the band picture, I can put an electron here, and this will stay there forever.
Right.
Yeah. Of course, I can always put this electron there. I don't.
But
energy.
You can hop the other chain.
Oh, but there's double exchange. That's correct, but let's say, assuming that in the low energy, etc.
So, what is the one of equation? So, it's one electron for two sides?
Exactly.
And then this electron goes to the bridge, if you want to main, or how much?
Yes, I'll tell you how much. I'll tell you how much now. So this picture is clear. The CE phase is a band insulator. It's the only statement I wanted to make. Because I've just filled this band here. Very, very simple. Now, charge order. So, we consider U not equal to 4, and we took T over U of 10. I gave you the qualitative statement already. So we did the calculation by three different means, exact organization, some mean fields, which should be good because I have a gap in the charge sector here for if the U is smaller than this gap. And we did a Goodswill projection. I'll not go into it, but this is the result. Interaction equals zero. There is no charge disproportionality. There is no reason for it to be there. I switch on the Coulomb interaction, and here the full curve is the exact diagonalization, and you see that there's the charge disproportionalization growing as a function of U, and for a very large U, it grows to here 0.18 or so. So it's 0.18. Exact diagonalization is, well, we did maximum 16 sides. No, this results 14, but I also did 16.
Is that the mean field curve?
The mean field curve is here. You see it exactly where you expect it to be good. It is good for U smaller than a gap. Mm-hmm. This is the projection, which is U infinity. Gives you here is 0.19 almost, which also agrees very nicely with the exact diagonalization.
What is the coincidence?
No, it's a number. I don't know why 0.18.
If you include the other level, the limit factor would go up a little bit more.
Yes. But if I put in the nearest neighbor Coulomb interactions, what I didn't tell or should have told is that in the CE phase, you said it, there are planes, are charge-ordered planes. If I put in Coulomb interactions, I always stabilize a state which is the lowest Madelung energy, which is rock salt.
In
any model. I mean, you take Coulomb interactions and you ask yourself, why do the electrons sit above each other instead of they can move one letter spacing without any energy cost? And they will move. They will not sit on top of each other.
Well, sometimes the electron is closer to sometimes.
Maybe, okay, it's hard for me to imagine, but the point is here, you say, okay, the charge order is intimately connected to the zigzag nature of these, the zigzag spin structure. So, as above each zigzag spin is a zigzag chain, there's another zigzag chain, the charge order will be exactly the same in the two chains. So, indeed, here you would get sheets of charged-ordered sheets, where if you do any reasonable calculation on a nearest neighbor Coulomb interacting model, you will get rock salt kind of charge order.
Is it
only
instead of
0.5
or
0.5?
Maximum
0.5. 0.5 is maximum, yeah. This is exactly at half film. Now if I start to dope, so here I go to the empty, to the calcium end member here, my charge disproportionation goes down very, very fast, which you can think of very easily because I have now moving electrons that destroy my charge order very, very efficiently. But
is it
exactly
one electron every other?
Yeah.
That's not chlorophyll.
Chlorophyll.
Oh, okay. What is
it? Because they're polarized. Yeah. Polarized. Yeah. Polarized.
Yeah.
So it is half
filled,
right?
Yeah.
Essentially
spin one. Yeah.
Okay.
Then why does U stay in your orbital?
Why does?
If it's spin polarized, why does U stay?
Because it's not orbital polarized.
Oh, I see. The U is between two orbits.
Two electrons on the same side and different orbitals.
Yeah.
That's the only residual interaction I still have.
What kind of Coulomb interaction are you?
Four. This number.
No, I mean it's a master's
no. So that's why?
Any orbital interact with U, yeah?
Yeah.
Your assumption.
Yeah. And this is rotational invariant.
Of course, if it's diagonal, it's rotational invariant.
There it cannot be, how can it be off diagonal?
So two orbitals?
I have two orbitals and two electrons ferromagnetically. I cannot do anything.
No, but even assume ferromagnetic system. If you have two orbitals, you know that you have U, U prime, and J.
I didn't assume ferromagnetic, but I am.
Second.
Not allowed. The spin is
and different spins also not allowed.
Exactly.
Yeah, because spin polarized. That's assuming that these are completely spin polarized. So it's there, of course, but it drops out.
But if you become large, if you become larger than any scale, all the discussion is meaningless, yeah?
Why?
Because in principle, you have all these interactions in different. If you become large,
But I have to put in these electrons with this spin. If I don't put them in, they don't interact.
It's strange.
Okay. So then the last thing was this. Sorry. No.
It's a metal. It's a band metal.
It's a very interesting metal because. Let's say if you dope in the band picture, of course, you just move your Fermi level, but now you have the on-site Coulomb interaction, which is very interesting physics now. I mean, you can think about Kondo types.
Yeah. To
what?
Doing some approximate theory of the effect of the on-site interaction.
Wow.
Not exactly.
I do three approximate theories that give me the same result. I do three approximate theories that give me the same result.
But the analytical theory would involve some approximate way of including the effect of the on-site
interaction. Yeah. Yes.
So can you go back to my question about, say, if you think about some more temperature feedback? So you start from this thing that changed, right?
Yeah.
Magnetic change.
Yeah.
So then that is kind of stable. So yeah. That I would imagine that, you know, that transition may occur at first, that's from the temperature. So if you detect magnetic volume force and then something gets developed later at first, that's not the case.
No, well, in this picture, I didn't do any calculation, but I expect that everything occurs at the same point. Soon as I get C8, CE type spin order, I get automatically also charge order. One is directly related to the other. I cannot think out how I could decouple.
Just start from Winnipeg chain.
Yeah.
Magnetic chain.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is the automatic comes in.
Yeah.
So to me.
So?
Okay.
No, I'm.
There's a broken symmetry assumed already. There is some kind of A on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this broken symmetry will disappear at some temperature.
Yes.
So as a function of the size of this broken symmetry parameter, you have to do your band structure. It will disappear at some temperature.
Yeah.
My guess is that temperature will be of the order of T. And that's very easy.
Why of the order of T? I don't understand. I would say. Why?
Because that's a very high temperature. You could say that you have been that chain order,
but
thousands of degrees.
No, but it's no, no.
Big dot is that chain. By energy conservation, it's of the order of T.
Yeah.
No, J.
J.
Yeah. J. Also, that's another part of the let's say, okay,
yeah.
Let me now do the argument why, according to me, CE is stable. Then we can discuss the other thing.
Can
yeah?
I make this point?
I will make a small loop and go back to the same point. So,
we have to go
so here is a function of doping. I just calculated the energies. So, C-type, which is one-dimensional chains. I start to fill them here, the energy goes down, and here, after 50% filling, the energy stays constant. Why? Because I start to fill up these orbitals that don't bind, like in the CE type. Yeah? Now, I calculate energy for the ferromagnet, which is this guy here, yeah? Which is here higher than the C type. Why? Because of the ferro has six bonds that are broken. And kinetic energy is not high enough to overcome this six broken bonds. So then we have the CE type, and you see here the CE type has a kink in the energy. Why it has this kink? Because of course there's this flat band. It's the same argument. I start to put in electrons, I put them in the dispersive band, then at some point I start to put them in the non-dispersive band, I don't gain any energy. So I have really a strong kink exactly at 50% doping. So now you can say, okay, here I would expect the C-type to be stable, here the CE, and below 50%, or here I would have the ferro. And because of, let's say, the Maxwell construction, you have this kink here, which always will give you phase separation. Yeah? So here I will have a phase-separated state. So that's just what the calculation gives you. So then the question is, okay, on which energies at finite temperature, whatever.
Yeah, the thermodynamic states out there too, right? For the answer,
exactly.
In some sense, at least in the ground state, you look at energy separation between the thermodynamic and your state.
Okay, look, I looked at zero temperature first. Right, it's the right, most reasonable thing to do. Then I can say zero temperature stabilization energy is on what scale? It's on J. It's in the T to G spins, yeah? Hopping magnetic energy. So the exchange between the T to G core spins. That's the most important thing. That competes with the kinetic energy. Yeah? So if these two scales are about the same, I will get some phase transitions. This T to G exchange is, I know, not so big. It's 100 Kelvin at most. Yeah? So on that scale, things happen at the zero temperature. Yeah? Then if I go at finite temperature, I didn't do any calculation, so I cannot tell you what comes out, but okay, you can speculate what you expect.
But
I didn't do the calculation. I don't know.
And also, this is probably important. This parameter is like a Fresnelian K10.5. Charge of the ordinary approach first. I think it's like 50 kilograms. And then to the magnetic ordinary approach, 150 kilograms. The low temperature.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that a lot of experiments have to deal with the fact that you have phase separation. So that charge order appearing at different temperature than magnetic order, and that can all be the case, but I would like to know for sure that it's all homogeneous systems, which I'm not always sure of in experiment. Okay. Yeah, so then I'll give you the conclusions. That was that the half-field manganites, the degenerate double exchange stabilizes the CE phase, which you just saw. Then the chains are intrinsically insulating orbital orders and charge orders, and that is charge order due to the on-site Coulomb interaction U, is a nice feature which I didn't see any before in any compound that it could happen. For doping smaller than a half, there is phase separation between the ferromagnetic and the CE phase domains, which I learned this morning make sense, could make sense. In a magnetic field, of course, we expect that the metal insulator transition from a CE type insulator to ferromagnetic metal, which can give you a lot of magnetic resistance. That's about it.
I think it was kind of discussion already. Maybe I would like, if you allow me, just say that you are safe. Wait until you make 10 minutes. Because it's not related to the story, but indeed.
Do you want a microphone?
Well, I don't. Well, I can.
Thank you.
I will just quickly remind you the basic things of the phase diagram. So basically, we start with and adopt, say, quantum manganese O3. This is my X. Say, for instance, lanthanum 1 minus X. I say calcium X manganese O3. Or maybe strontium. I start with A-type antiferromagnetic state and also orbitally ordered state. And orbital ordering, we know, crudely speaking, what it is in undoped material. It's not exactly as I draw it, but more or less this orbital and more or less this orbital. It's kind of anti-ferro ordering in the basal plane. In next plane, it's the same in phase, but it's not so important even. Now, we dope the system, and nail temperature goes down, and then we get up to 3.5 in the good materials. I just ignore, say, for a while, this charge holding close to 1.8. We also worked on that, but we have a ferromagnetic metallic state. And then here we have this charge ordered and insulating state and so on. Okay, here at point 5, we have this charge ordering and CE type with all the details which you heard about just right now. So there is orbital ordering here, it plays an important role. There is definitely charge and orbital ordering here. Now here, as we saw, if you dope in this way, an overdope regime, there are really bands, formally speaking, but they may be polarized, orbitally polarized. So I don't know whether to call it orbital ordering or not, that's depending on your taste. I am used to call orbital ordering if it's localized orbital, but okay, we can also say that orbital polarization. Anyway, the question is, what happens with orbital degrees of freedom here? That's essentially my point, my question. We used to think that spins are perfectly polarized, ferromagnetic, but it is known that, for instance, that's what you also saw. Here, this is what people often call O' orthorhombic phase, which is have this distortion, local distortion, Yantella-like ordering, or the loading, which essentially disappears in optimally doped material. So material in optimal doping is essentially cubic. It's not really cubic because it's tilted, it's orthorhombic, but octahedra are regular. So there is nothing left of at least static orbital ordering and static local distortions. What happens with orbital? Now, the question is twofold. It could be, of course, that it's simply a metal, and if I ignore completely all my correlations, then fine, I have, say, for instance, only one band, but I can have two bands which may be degenerate at gamma point, maybe do something else further on, and I occupy, say, up to certain points in one band, certain points in another band, and maybe a bit more complicated Fermi surface with some pockets and so on. They're going to different bands. Fine, that's what band structure people would tell you. Forget about correlations, and well, I don't care whether it's one band or two bands, it's simply band index. However, if I have some correlations, then I have to worry about that. And I believe that we have to worry about that. If U is, say, of order of 4 or maybe even just bigger, and bandwidth is maybe, okay, 2 even, maybe 1.5, then I have to think what should I do with this orbital degrees of freedom. And people really give different answers. Some people claim that, okay, it's cubic, but maybe something like orbital liquid, like same fluctuations. Could be, I don't know actually how to describe this state. I cannot exclude it, really. But I want to discuss another possibility, that maybe when I go from here to here, my orbital order is not really destroyed, but modified somehow. Now, what is logic? What are we used to think about doped mode insulator? I start, for instance, let's for beginning think of the spin situation. I start with.
So when you go from near phase, these are all planes which are orbitally ordered, and
yeah.
Each plane is a ferromagnetic.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But finally, I made totally ferromagnetic, but so orbital ordering, there is no trace left, at least not at lower, not at ground state. There may be some fluctuations at higher temperatures, and that people saw it in this PDF measurement, this measure local correlations. But they eventually go away if you go deep inside ferromagnetic state. So it looks as though in ferromagnetic state we really have quite regular octahedra. So what happens? Now what to do is, now I want to go back slightly and without any rigorous rule, but remind you what do we have in doped mode insulator. I start with, for instance, with partially filled Hubbard model. It's anti-ferromagnetic. If I put some holes, then holes have some problems to move in this anti-ferromagnetic background. They leave a trace of wrong spins and so on and so forth, something like confinement maybe. And final outcome is that the hole, in principle, they would be more happy if they make it all ferromagnetic. Then they can gain as much kinetic energy as possible. And that was we used to call Nagaoka ferromagnetism in non-degenerate case, or we speak about double exchange if it's a two-band model or whatever. So anyway, to gain kinetic energy, it's better to make all spins parallel, ferromagnetic. Now, but I may expect the same thing also for orbitals. Here I have something like anti-ferro-orbital ordering. In principle, in contrast to spin case, when the first approximation, classically, it cannot hop at all. But here it can hop without disturbing, without leaving a trace of wrong orbital.
because there is still finite overlap. I have, for instance, here, I may have, for instance, zero here, originally. But then this orbital hops not to this one, but it hops to occupy the same orbital which it had to occupy. And here is my hole. So in principle, there are non-diagonal hoppings. It means another way that in my matrix elements, I have Cij alpha beta, C dagger I alpha sigma, Cj beta sigma. Then sigma are my spin indices. And this hopping case, of course, conserves spins. So it's diagonal with respect to spin. But these are my orbital indices. And this, generally speaking, is non-diagonal with respect to orbital. So in principle, I can move. I can propagate the hole in orbital order, anti-ferro orbital order state, without disturbing this magnetic order. But still, it will reduce my bandwidth. And I will make better things if I make it totally ferromagnetic. So my bandwidth, essentially, that is will be what I have this orbitally anti-ferro state. But if I make it orbitally ferro, then it will do something crazy. This will be orbitally ferro. I gain something of order of t. So it's definitely the same as in Hubbard model. It's definitely better to make it orbitally ferro. Now, it's kind of Nagaoka in orbital state. In orbital state. Now, but this contradiction, this claim that it's essentially cubic and regular. Now, how do we usually describe this orbital ordering? This, for instance, we have doubly degenerate states, so we have spin 1/2, and we have also two other states which we can describe as pseudo spin, which is equal 1/2. So that, for instance, pseudo spin Cz equal plus 1/2 is correspond to orbital z square. And they tell z equal to minus 1/2 correspond to x squared minus y squared orbital. Okay? Then it's convenient to describe it all in this plane, theta plane, because I can, in principle, have any linear combination of these two orbitals. I can, for instance, take linear combination of a kind. Okay, let me. Once again, doubly degenerate orbitals, and I doubly degenerate orbitals, of course. This is my doubly degenerate Hubbard model, if you like. I start with doubly degenerate Hubbard model. But now I consider, say, state of one particular site, and in principle, it can occupy, electron can occupy either orbital z square or x square minus circuit or any linear combination of that. Let's call this linear combination theta, and I can write it down as cosine theta over 2 z square plus sine theta over 2 x squared minus y squared. And I can describe everything. Oops, I already started to draw this plane, but okay. In this plane, then I have z tau x. And this state would correspond to z square orbital. This state would be x squared minus y squared orbital. Then there is 2 pi over 3 symmetry, because I can also have z square, but I can also have x square or y square. So here it will be x squared, here it will be y squared, here it will be what it is, xz, so x squared minus z squared, and so on. But each of these combinations still give you certain distortion. It's kind of quadrupolar distribution of charge density, so it will induce some distortion. So it's not what I want. Now, I can calculate kinetic energy. Suppose still I make this, for instance, tau z ferromagnetism, or z square. All occupied orbitals are z square. I can calculate, I can put one hole in this state. I put all orbitals z square, put one hole, calculate its kinetic energy. I gain some bandwidth. And I think it's minus 3 t in some minor direction. Okay. Now I can take all orbitals, say, for instance, x square minus y square, ferro. And I see that again I have the same bandwidth, again the same energy. So any theta, whatever I do, gives me the same bottom of the band. Further on, density of state may be slightly different because anisotropy is different. But the bottom of the band is the same. So my kinetic energy, essentially, if I start doping, I occupy this state at the bottom. So I gain as much kinetic energy as possible, independent of which kind of orbital I take. And that's good, so that seems to be okay. It follows, it's consistent with all this logic that we have to make it as ferromagnetic as possible, but it's not consistent with the fact that it's cubed. And now I want to suggest what crazy idea. Whoever told you that this coefficient should be real? Why shouldn't I take linear combination, which is the following one? Say, for instance, plus, or I can take minus z square plus or minus I x squared minus y squared. And then make ferromagnetic ordering of these guys. Everywhere I put my this complex orbital. Now, in terms of these pseudo spins, all these states correspond to either some tau z, tau x plane. And this state would correspond to non-zero tau y, which we always ignore when we speak about these orbitals, usually. But it's in algebra. Why not? Now, what is the state? It's, you can easily check that it's perfectly cubic. So there is no change of density. There's no quadrupole, electric quadrupole moment. So it's perfectly cubic. Nevertheless, it's a unique state. This breaks time inverse. Sorry? That's a bit more subtle. More or less correct. It breaks time reversal invariance. Yeah, that's magnetic octopole. That's first in EG state. In EG state, there is no magnetic dipole because it's quenched. Then magnetic quadrupole is absent because of symmetry, because it's even wave functions. EG and magnetic quadrupole can exist only in odd wave functions. It's pseudo vector and then pseudo tensor. Then the first would be magnetic octopole. I don't know how to measure magnetic octopole. But that's essentially what I want to suggest, that isn't it possible that this ferromagnetic state is perfectly ordered ferromagnetically, both in spin and in orbital, but with this strange complex orbital?
Will this complex combination also, will it mean there has to be a coherent rotation of, suppose there is some distortion, the Antlerian distortion?
No, there will be no Antlerian distortion, because Antlerian distortion couples to charge density, and charge density is complex. Exactly homogeneous. It's equal in all x, y, z. So it remains cubic. That's why I like it. Because it remains cubic. It remains cubic. But it's unique orbital. So it's perfectly orbitally ordered state. Which one? Energy. Fine. Fine. Last argument about energy. And that comes to the following thing. As I said, all real orbitals have exactly the same bottom of the bed. If you check this one, you immediately see that it again gives exactly the same bottom of the band. So at least not worse. Not better, but not worse. Now, but it's somewhat better from the point of view of exchange direction, super exchange, which would still remain. And that's actually, of course, not a very rigorous argument, because then I have to consider really doped material and how to divide this energy, which part is kinetic energy, which part is exchange. But still, if I start doping from here, I have my super exchange. And my super exchange, which usually takes a form t square over u, say, for instance, s dot s, here I have not only s, but I have also orbital operators. And my effective Hamiltonian looks following. It's s dot s plus tau dot tau plus cross terms ss tau tau. This may be a somewhat different coefficient, actually. If you include Hounsfield cupping, then coefficient may be slightly different. But what is important, all coefficients are positive. So it wants to be by itself, it wants to be anti-ferro, both with respect to orbital, for instance. Now, this term is always s dot s is su2, because it's color products. Spin notation invariant. But with respect to these guys, it's not really spherically symmetric, so to say, because of different shape of orbitals, different hopping. And if you do it carefully, you see that in realistic cases, these terms contain terms of order of, say, tau z tau z plus tau x, maybe again with different coefficients, square root of 2. Sometimes may contain also tau z tau x, but it doesn't contain tau y. And that's why, by the way, probably it was never considered before, because there is no tau y in Hamiltonian, so why should we consider such a strange state? And of course, if you have undoped material, you have to minimize this energy. So you have to choose some ordering with respect to spin, some ordering with respect to orbitals. And of course, you have to choose something in this subspace, either tau z ferro or tau z anti ferro or tau x ferro, or maybe some combination. Now, suppose I dope my system. I force my system, using this logic, if this argument is correct, I force my system to be ferro, both in spin and orbital. In spin, it doesn't matter whether it's ferro, this spins here or here or here. In orbital, it does matter. Because if it's ferro, then it's positive energy, it's my energy loss. And then I can minimize this loss if I flip it and make it tau y ferro. So tau y ferro has lower, smaller exchange energy. It's better because I can use this opportunity and make use of this. Okay, that's more or less the end of the story. Actually, there is something like phase separation in all this story also as well, so the total energy would look like something like this. I start with A type, and then I have my tau y ferro, and here I have somewhere here I have actually, for instance, tau theta ferro, real orbital ferro. Actually, they will cross somewhere. Doping this way, yeah. X. They cross because of the following thing, actually. And that's actually a question. I didn't really calculate whether there is a good window for that. That's a question. But why they cross? That's because of the following thing. As I said, bottom of the band is the same. But my kinetic energy is actually minus 3t times x doping, linear term, plus some terms which are of the order of, say, for instance, t times something like here in cubic case, phi short or whatever, some bent filling. And bent filling, actually, it's not so favorable for my orbitals. Because in my orbitals, my density of state is actually, it's completely symmetric in all three directions, so it's cubic. So my density of state in my case, it's like this, square root at the end. And say, for instance, if I occupy only x square minus y square orbitals, then my band would be two-dimensional. A two-dimensional band has higher density of state here. So finally, I lose when I have band filling. Or maybe in 1D case, if I occupy z square orbitals, then my band would start as something like this also, but then it will develop something like peak. Well, not real one-hole singularity, but something like one-hole singularity in 1D. And then maybe it will be more favorable to occupy this band instead of, say, having this one. I may gain some kinetic energy for finite band. But at low band filling, at least, this seems to dominate. Yeah, question? Tau y ferro means simply this state. Yeah, I suppose it is positive side at everything, or negative side at everything. Then, in principle, it's we just discussed it about an hour ago. I did not really check if I make, say, plus minus sublattices, say, plus sublattice, minus sublattice. I have to check it, but I suspect that it will, because of these different signs, plus minus, this interference will decrease my kinetic energy, but I'm not 100% sure. Until now, I simply considered that it should be fairer. Following this logic, actually, that doping is most happy if it's fairer in everything. Okay. Yep.
Why do you think it not exists in previous or in your both mean field calculations?
As I explained to you already that in undoped material, my effective Hamiltonian doesn't contain tau y. And then I have to, when I minimize it in mean field way, for instance, it would always choose some state which has some non-zero tau z or tau x to minimize energy. Yeah, it was always all our previous work, what we did with Kugel, actually, what the people referred to. Ah, no, with this one?
No,
This one. No, well, we didn't consider the situation.
No, the band structure don't know if you're real orbital or not real. If you're Hamiltonian.
Yeah, but it's... No, but it's T invariant, actually. And here I assume that this T invariant is broken. This broken symmetry state, the time reversal symmetry is broken, and we considered only ordinary band-like state. So there's different class of states. That I don't know. Actually, for EG orbitals, in first order, spin orbit coupling is quenched. Orbital momentum is quenched. But in principle, there exists second order contribution, and I don't know what would remain of this state if I include spin orbit. I don't know. Now, as to, by the way, there were actually, I have to be, to tell you that actually, in principle, possibilities of tau y fermentism was considered in two old papers by two Russian guys, Korovin and Kudinov, who considered simply, they didn't have in mind any particular situation, doping, but they simply made symmetric classification of all possible states, and they saw that there exists one possibility of this kind. It's simply you take EG and you make this, see that it contains some singlet representation, but also contains EG representation, this product, if you decompose it. No, I want to make it metallic. I argue that just because it wants to be metallic, it stabilizes the state.
So, there is a two orbital. Another counterpart is high energy after. It's not occupied at all.
Yeah, I assume that. Yeah, I assume to gain kinetic energy. No, this orbital order state. Orbital order state, because there are two orbitals, plus and minus, and I occupy only plus and minus.
This would be
two
orbital orders.
Huh?
This would be two orbital orders.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. If you like, it will be a later distortion. Orbital ordering without any entailer this effect on any later distortion, sure. In a sense, yes.
That seems very stable, right?
Hmm?
In that sense, it doesn't cost any lattice energy.
It doesn't cost any lattice energy, but you also don't gain any lattice energy. Usually you gain something on the antenna. So that's actually, I wouldn't claim that it's better from this point of view. Usually antenna decrease your energy. So I don't gain this energy, antenna gains it. So maybe that's, I would like to use this argument as you do, but I don't think.
Nothing else. If you go to complex harmonics, this is why
this
m equal to plus 2
or
minus.
That will be if I consider l equal 2, to it will be l 0 1 over square root of 2 plus or minus I, and here I have to put, say, I just forgot, I always forget signs, plus, minus 2, something like this. Or maybe minus here, I just always forget which is actually EG. So EG orbitals, one of them is LZ equals 0, and another is 2 plus minus 2, or 2 minus 2, I just forget. And that will be a combination of these ones, but one of them is I. So that's not really ordinary momentum. No.
What
not coolant. No. No coolant interaction. It's kinetic energy. It's kinetic energy. Yeah, okay. Sasha, let me ask you. When you consider double exchange, is it important for you whether you make it ferromagnetic, but whether your ferromagnetic moment looks, say, here or here or here?
No,
okay. The same is in my case. I get ferromagnetic, but... Nevertheless, all these states are degenerate, but still it's unique state. If I have some symmetry breaking, if I have... yeah, of course, it will be spontaneous symmetry breaking. And the same in my case. In tau space, I have the same symmetry breaking. And if I chosen this tau y, then it stays tau y. Autoromic because of tilting. That's a special problem. I don't know how important will it be.
Will perturb the huffing interval.
Yeah, but in any case, claim experimental claim is that there is nothing left of orbital effects, like local Antler or whatever. So in that sense, that's what I have in mind. And of course, there are a lot of complications in the realistic system. I have to take into account all this tilting of octahedra, this Gilbert-Romnik. Maybe I have to take into account also the second order spin orbit coupling and so on and so forth. That I don't know. Yeah, of course, of course, of course. Yeah, maybe it will be a kind of a pseudo-degenerate state, and if this splitting, initial splitting is very large, then of course nothing will be left of that. And that's what we have, for instance, in this cuprates, when there is a splitting which is pretty large, and we are quite happy with x bar minus y squared, and we forget about z squared. Well, that is a question I don't know really. If I assume, I think that the most natural thing is to expect that it will disappear simultaneously with spin ordering. But I don't really know. You mean just this height temperature?
Yeah, it's even parity, that's the admixture between your...
this one.
Right. If it's even parity, you could have a linear admixture at that transition between your...
Yeah, maybe interesting, actually. I didn't know about... I only heard about this thing this morning, so maybe it's a good combination, really.
Right.
Yeah, might be interesting, really, to think about. Yeah, could be.
No,
could be. No, but this rhombohedral is higher temperature.
No, I mean, the ferromagnetic moment and the ferro-polar moment would appear at the same temperature.
Yeah, I would expect that they should appear at the same temperature because suppose I already destroyed ferromagnetic order. I already kind of destroyed my coherent motion. Then why should, from point of view of spin, so why should it remain coherent in orbitals? It shouldn't, I think. Well, well, in principle, wait a minute. Ferromagnetic orbital, ferro-orbital ordering is on a scale of T. It's better than disordered. Okay, wait.
You're quoting defining
let me tell once again. Just let me finish sentence. If I compare my ferro orbital order state and completely disordered state, then it's a scale on the scale of T. If I compare different ferro orbital states, this complex orbital states, tau y state, or this tau z on tau x state, then difference between these guys is a order of T square over U.
Well, there is a very simple thing you can do, is do a hyperfocal calculation of this Hubbard model, and actually, if you do it, you take T over U equals 10, you get that this state is stable.
Yeah, could be. I don't know. I didn't do it. I didn't do it. Well. It's zero doping. I don't have it, first of all, because this tau y doesn't enter my Hamiltonian. And if I want to minimize my Hamiltonian, then of course it should find minimum in the subspace of operators which exist here. No. This kind of Nagaoka, because I don't lose as much as possible. I don't gain anything on these terms, but I lose less. I force it to be ferromagnetic, not what it wants to do by itself. By itself, it wants to be anti-ferro. If I force to do it ferro, then it prefers to flip to lose not so much. You mean here? Yeah, whether I'm already, where I'm still in this regime or I'm already in this regime. Yeah, well, that I don't know. Yeah. No, that I don't know really. That I don't know.
Would that be a first order phase transition?
No, I would expect first of all that this would be kind of this one, and then this one, okay, it may also be again phase separated like this. I don't really know what happens here. I didn't look in details at this part.
Experimentally, so we have to measure some particle
probably NMR, probably something like this. I don't know. I don't know how to measure.
This ordering will be better for larger bandwidth, right? So T, larger T.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Probably, yeah. Probably, yeah. Probably, yeah. Probably, yeah.
Length of transition, that ordering will be better than amplification for the
amplifier. I think so.
Okay.
The broken symmetry, does it commute to the Hamiltonian?
Well,
probably that's not.
There is such representation. If I just take this EG and EG cross EG, I just decompose it into.
You guys can both go on board.
Well, except that this is really, it's not really that you only have this discrete, right? You can still, in this Tauy order, you still only can.
Well, and no, well, that again, that's actually a question. No, I think that actually, no, then I think that the phases are fixed here, so actually. I don't think that I can just manipulate with the phases. I think they are really fixed, so it's kind of, I think. But it's like in, say, Exponic oscillator, the phases are usually fixed, say, for instance, either in real parameter or imaginary parameter, it's not something in between. But, well, again, I can't guarantee it. In principle, they are slightly different, but in any case, they're all positive. They're all positive, that's for sure. Actually, this is not really a different coefficient, but it's even different coefficient along different directions.
Yeah.
So it may be along z, it may, along z direction, it may be also only tau z, along x, y, it will contain some mixture and so on.
So
but coefficients are always positive.
But it's already anisotropic, it's not.
Yeah, but it's 2 pi over 3, you can rotate it from z to y.
Symmetry. In other words, it's
yeah.
Not a continuous rotational.
That's very strange. Well, actually, that's very strange model by itself. It has some hidden symmetry, probably. I don't understand it. Maybe we can discuss it. It's a very funny model by itself. This model, if I take into account all this anisotropy, even without any doping, without any tau wire, that's a separate problem, but it's a very funny model which has some strange symmetry behind it. Each pair looks like Ising, but say it looks like the following model. Very cute model, actually. And it looks as though you have, say, tau z for spins ij parallel to z. And crudely speaking, you can model it something like this, tau x for spins parallel to x plus tau y spins parallel to y. This has very strange symmetry. That's not exactly like this. That's not exactly like this, but that may be a simple model to illustrate it somehow, to maybe to study. Okay, I think that we have to move on. Yeah, sure. Yeah, okay. Russian. Aren't you?
Okay, so after all the discussions, maybe some concrete results.
Real
results. Okay, so what am I going to talk about is basically the something along the similar theme. You can hear me?
Put that on.
Okay, so this will work. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the effect of vibrations on magnetism. Okay, so basically I will cover three different issues which are related. The first is I'm going to treat the crystal as a collection of Jahn-Teller centers, and we'll try to study the effect of band structure on the adiabatic potential surface. Okay, and second, I will show that from there you can understand all the magnetic interactions in the various compounds, the two end members and also the 50% compound. And that is the so-called the static vibrational coupling, where the oxygen nuclear wave functions are treated classically. So, of course, it's well known in chemistry that the quantum mechanical nuclear wave function, which is known as the dynamical vibrational coupling, also plays an important role. And in this case, I will show that you can understand the isotope effect if you include the quantum mechanical nuclear wave function in there. Okay, so the as everyone here knows, the important Jahn-Teller distortion mode at the so-called the Q1, Q2, and the Q3 modes, and then the two important orbitals are the two easy orbitals in the system. Okay, so that's what we are going to build base our model on. Let me remind you the electron nuclear problem. So basically, you have a Hamiltonian. You have the electronic term, the vibrational terms, and the coupling between them. Okay, so the way you solve it is you fix the nuclear coordinates at zero and solve the electronic structure problem, and then you get a complete set of states. And for any finite vibrational mode, degrees of freedom, you expand the electronic state as in a basis set of what you got before, and then you come to a Schrodinger equation. And the W here are the matrix elements of VRQ minus VR0. Q is the strength of the vibrational mode. And then you can expand that. And this is what is known as the linear hybridic coupling constant. And that is the quadratic hybridic coupling constant. Okay. Now, for example, in our problem, we have an easy electronic system. So we'll get a 2x2 Hamiltonian if we just formulate this thing. Okay. Now, this small z and capital Z are known in chemistry, and that leads to some interesting effects. The Hamiltonian you get is well known to many here. You can use the group theory and figure out the form of the Hamiltonian, and you can write this in terms of the pseudo spin, which Chomsky described a few minutes ago, and then you get a 2x2 Hamiltonian, which has this form. Q3 and Q2 are the strength of the Jahn-Teller vibrational modes. This one is well known in chemistry. This I'm doing now for an isolated manganese oxide molecule. I'm later going to put it on a solid and see what happens. Okay. Now, if you solve this, you get a energy surface which does not depend on phi. Okay. You have a energy surface is two different sheets. And the minimum is given by some rho zero, which is dependent on those parameters there. Okay, so this is for a single isolated molecule. Okay, so this is the result. You get the so-called the Mexican hat type of adiabatic potential surface if you only keep the linear coupling. Okay, so as a function of phi, your energy is the same. Now, if you include the quadratic coupling, however, you can show from group theory that this is the form of the quadratic coupling, and then you get these three minima surface here. Okay, this M1, M2, and M3. Okay, and that corresponds to the elongation or contraction of the X or the Y or the Z type of directions. Okay, so this is what you get is a single isolated molecule. Now, of course, in our solid we have a collection of those centers. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a simple model. Yeah. The capital Z or small Z? Let's see. I believe it does not. Well, it matters in the sense that the minima are shifted. So if you see from there. But otherwise, it should not matter. I mean, you'd always get three minima and three maxima. I mean, you might get the minima at three different places. I don't know. But. Right, the minimum might shift here. That's right. I mean, your minima might shift over there. It's that's possible, but you'll always get three minima. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now what I do is, so now I consider a center, a collection of these Jahn-Teller centers, and this is your Hamiltonian, this is your elastic energy, and this is the coupling between the two different nearest neighbors, and this is the on-site Jahn-Teller interaction term, and that's the kinetic energy term. Okay, and then you have the Schoen-Schulze coupling there. Okay, and the hopping matrix elements are the Coaster-Slater type of hopping matrix element that everyone knows. Okay. Now, what's my goal? My goal is to figure out what kind of configuration I'll have, what kind of Q2, Q3 I'll have in the crystal. Okay, so I will take various Q2 and Q3 and compute the energy and minimize it. So that's done in a tight binding model. So that's my tight binding model, and here I have done it for the A structure. That's the A type A magnetic structure for the lanthanum manganite, and my unit cell has two atoms in the unit cell. So I have Q2 Q3 and Q2 prime Q3 prime. That's the distortion there. Okay. So with that, I'll get my band structure is two dimensional easy bands. I can write it down. And you can just do that. Now the interesting thing is on the side, this Hamiltonian becomes very simple at the R point, and you can diagonalize it analytically. And then you can find that at the R point, the that's this point, right? Okay, so you can. Well, this is just my definition of R. I don't know what people call it. That's right. So here you find that your delta E linearly depends on G, on Q2, okay? And the coefficient is G. Whereas if you take the Q3 distortion, you have a capital G appearing there to apart from that linear order, okay? And then the higher orders are Q3, okay? Now, that means now I can now go back and do a band calculation and figure out my G, small g and capital G, which will be useful in studying my energetics. Okay? So what I'm going to do in my band calculation is I'm going to control the amount of Q2 or Q3 I put in and look at that splitting. Okay? It's pi over 2a, so pi, it's halfway, yeah.
So, once again, did you get a difference between Q2 and Q3? What is it?
I'm going to show that. Yeah, I'm going to tell you what I get. Well, I'll talk about it, yeah. There is a difference. So, this is now my density functional calculation, and what I do is I have a certain value of Q2, and when I do the band calculation on the delta E, that's, remember, it is proportional to my G. So I just plot my Q2 versus my delta E, and the slope, it's a beautiful straight line, and the slope will give me G of about 2 electron volt per angstrom. Okay? And similarly, the Q3 mode it is quadratic, and from there, I can figure out my capital G, which is also about 2 volt per angstrom square. Okay, so this is the typical value of small g and capital G in the solid. Okay, now what is the effect of the band structure?
Well,
so,
Well,
that's just the structure of the of your Hamiltonian. So, So now, what is the effect of the band structure? So this is your easy orbital, and to linear order, your on-site Jahn-Teller distortion splits them to minus GQ and plus GQ. Okay, this is the Jahn-Teller energy, and now the band structure formation will reduce the energy by some, but the amount of energy reduction depends on what kind of Q2, what kind of distortion you have, because depending on your distortion, your tight binding hopping matrix elements are different. Okay, so and in fact, you can do a very simple trivial theory, because here I'm talking of the lanthanum manganites, so my energy gain is going to come from hopping to the unoccupied orbitals at nearest neighbor sites. Okay, so here in a simple picture, I have my easy electron orbital here, and it can couple to the four nearest neighbor ones. So you can do a 5 by 5 Hamiltonian matrix, and you can find that your delta E goes like 2V minus GQ, and in the limit Q equal to infinity, delta E is 4V squared over 2GQ. Okay. So now you can go and do a calculation by getting the band structure and occupying them up to the, you know, the Willon zone or however many electrons are there, and add them up, and that's my band structure energy gain. And so this is what I find. Now here, for example, focus on that line here. Here my distortions are only Q2 type. So here I have plus Q2, there is I have minus Q2. Now in the experiment, it's more or less like that, apart from a small Q3 mixed in. Okay? So you see that one has actually, in fact, the largest gain. I want a system with its largest delta E. And my delta E is largest, in fact, for that Q2 and minus Q2. Okay? And you do indeed see that I have a linear dependence on Q, and then it goes to zero as Q becomes large. Okay? So the band structure does differentiate between different type of distortions. This one, for example, it has Q3 minus Q3 type of distortion.
Yeah, but you said, so I'm confused, that's a simple point. You said that's the largest energy.
Yeah, this is the largest energy gain. So the largest energy, right there. So the largest energy, the better off I am. Okay? And you see the band structure would actually prefer zero distortion. So it's in some kind of an elastic energy term. Okay? And the physics of that is actually quite trivial, because you have to the second order, you have T square over delta, right? So the T square over Q. So it likes not to be distorted. So now, so from here it is clear that the system wants that kind of thing. And now I have a contour plot now. This is the contour plot of the band structure energy gain. Okay? And the band structure energy gain is maximum at the center, and then it falls off in various directions. Okay, now this is of course not the only energy gain, because I have the Antler energy and I have the elastic energy term. So I have to add them up and figure out my total energy in the system, and the minimum of that will give me the structure within this model. So I have done that, and then you get this kind of energy surface, this adiabatic energy surface, as opposed to this one, for the case of the isolated molecule. Okay, so what has the band structure term done? Well, it has removed that degeneracy, and it has just has these two, and it has shifted them to this angle phi is now 24 degree instead of being what's that? Let's see. I guess that's 24 degree. Okay, instead of being 30 degree, that's now 24 degree. Okay, which means that I have a small amount of Q3 different from the isolated molecule. Okay, and this in fact is what is observed in the lanthanum manganite, and also if you look at the type of the electronic structure there, the orbital ordering comes out naturally from this kind of interaction. Okay, so the upshot is that the orbital ordering is coming from the specific type of electronic hopping. Okay, and that's what you see in the experiment. Now, actually, this kind of orbital ordering also comes out from the density functional calculation, which we had done, and also Pickett and Singh had done in 3 years ago. You actually, from the full-blown density functional calculation, you actually also get the orbital ordering that you see in the system. Okay, this is just an aside. Okay, so now. Q2 is about 0.2 angstrom and Q3 is like 0.08 or something. It's very much comparable to the experiment. So you reproduce that. Okay, so now I'm back to my second issue that I posed. What is the effect of the static Jahn-Teller interaction on magnetism? Okay. And I explained the orbital. Everybody knows the orbital ordering here. In the calcium manganite, you have the type G structure. In the lanthanum manganite, you have this type A with the specific orbital ordering. And in the 50% doped compound, you have this particular zigzag 10 change in the structure. Okay? And of course, I did not study this case in any great detail. I did study this case, and so that the orbital ordering comes from the specific type of Jahn Pillow distortion we have in the system. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take the static ordering, and I'll show that all the magnetic interactions in the system can be explained by in a simple model if I just assume the easy electrons only and then the orbital ordering. So orbital ordering and then the easy electrons. So those two things I have. And on the T to Z orbitals will be like passive orbitals, okay? So the model is a three-shell model that any of these exact diagonalization guys can do pretty fast, right? So this is my model. I have three sites, manganese, oxygen, manganese, okay? And I have the Coulomb interaction, on-site Coulomb interaction, and I have the hopping, and then I have the Hund-Schultz coupling, and then this is a simple Hamiltonian. I have only a few electrons, so I can solve it by exact diagonalization or I can solve it by perturbation theory. Typically, I will present the exact diagonalization result or the perturbation theory to argue my case. Okay. Okay, so if you look at the calcium manganite, this theta is the angle, manganese, oxygen, manganese angle, and you in fact find that you should always have an antiferromagnetic interaction. Okay. And you get that as observed in the experiment. For the case of the lanthanum manganite, you have two different type of interactions. You have this type, which is ferromagnetic on the plane, and you have this type, which is antiferromagnetic. Now, what is the difference between them? The orbital ordering is the only difference between them. Okay, here it is pointing this way, and that's like that, and here it is parallel. Okay, and you can, in fact, that's what also comes out from this exact diagonalization calculation, that you have antiferromagnetic interaction between this and that. Theta here is approximately 180 degrees. And here you have, well, this is not relevant to this compound because this doesn't occur. And this one will be ferromagnetic as observed in the experiment. Okay? And you can also explain all the, now there is no adjustable parameter. The parameters that are needed, like delta, the charge transfer energy, UP and all that thing are reasonable and are taken from experiment. Okay, so this is the manganese orbitals are now perpendicular to the bond. So it is like this situation. See, the oxygen is here, it's not shown here. Okay, that's the oxygen. The theta is 180 degrees. Right. But this is a more general case. So you should just look at those two. Right. So that's the angle theta. Here theta is roughly 180 degrees. But as you see, the theta doesn't really so much matter. Okay. Right. Because this is a function of theta. So you just bend it like that. Theta is 180 degree corresponds to that bond. Here.
What about green one? Why
is the green one is just, I just did it for the sake of completeness, but that is not seen in this. This one is zero in this model. So there is no magnetic interaction. Well, that's because it doesn't couple with the oxygen P. I have only the nearest neighbor hopping. And if my oxygen orbitals are like that, if this is 180 degree, at least 180 degree is easy to explain. Okay? There's no coupling. Yeah. But see, the oxygen orbital here, there's no interaction. Oxygen orbital, P orbital, there's no interaction between those two. See, this comes from fourth order perturbation theory. So you not only have to have the hopping from one to the middle oxygen, but then the next oxygen to the manganese.
No, but suppose I have manganese, the oxygen sitting in the green orbit of all like
this. Right.
So there is stronger scientific error.
Well, that's what you have with zero. No. See, in my
degree, yeah, but okay, that's what I asked. The theta should be taken from the table. And if I just bend it like this and make it from the table,
how many orbitals are
rotating?
Oh, X and Y and Z.
Three orbitals,
right.
Should
but it is not. Well, you can discuss that later. Yeah. I mean, this is... No, this is the result of an exact diagonalization calculation. I mean, it's exact. I mean... Okay, so the last last issue is the going to include the nuclear quantum mechanical wave function for the oxygen nuclei and show how the magnetic interactions are modified. Okay, and the motivation for that, of course, is the isotope shift experiment, where the TC changes from 16 degrees to 210 degrees, 290 degrees when you go from 016 to 018. So there is a large shift.
Okay. That maybe you can take the mixed quantum regime, much larger.
Right. Okay. So now I want to claim that this is the result of the oxygen nuclear wave function. Okay. And so what I'm going to do is, again, I'm going to convince you, I'm going to present the result of a simple model along the lines of Anderson Asagawa. So everybody knows this model here. I have the manganese, and then the oxygen in between, but oxygen really doesn't play any role here. It's neglected. You just have some kind of a hopping. And we have a T cosine theta over 2 term that everybody knows, the double exchange term. Okay. Now what I'm going to do is, I'm going to give a degree of freedom to the oxygen atom and see what happens to the J. Okay. And so that's, again, a simple model. You have two manganese and one oxygen in between. Okay, you can think of the mode I have taken as the vibration of a simple single oxygen atom, or you can think of as the oscillations of this vibrational mode, the QT of the Q3 mode. Okay, now the Hamiltonian is quite simple. So you have the on-site energies here. The 1 and 2 are the two different manganese atoms, and this is the hopping between them. And then you have a nuclear. This is the kinetic energy of the nucleus. And then here, if the electron is on the site 1, the oxygen moves in one potential well. If it is on the site 2, it moves in the second potential well. Okay. Now this Hamiltonian is the so-called one boson, one fermion model that has been looked at by many people. And we can do this thing by actually exact diagonalization. We can do that. We can also do that in the Born-Oppenheimer approximation or anything you have. You can do all of that. Okay. Let me present you just the result. Okay, then you have one point here. So this is the result. This is the result of the exact diagonalization and also Born-Oppenheimer approximation here. So this is the antiferromagnetic energy and this is the ferromagnetic energy, and the difference of those two gives you the J. Okay. Now one important point that maybe I should point out to an audience in physics is that whenever you do the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, you always get a lower energy to the exact energy as opposed to the upper. This is a well-known theorem in chemistry that tells you that. Okay, so if you take the difference, but most people, if you ask them without showing them the result, they will think it's an upper bound. Yeah. Okay, so, well, I have my temperature is zero. Yeah. So anyway, so this is probably one of the key results. So delta is the strength of the electron phonon coupling. Okay, and this Anderson Hasegawa limit. So that is my T. My T is 0.15 volt. Okay. Now if I have the electron phonon coupling, then my J is drastically reduced. In fact, if I take my delta is 0.1 or something in this case, it is reduced by about factor of 2. So the electron phonon coupling actually will reduce the magnitude, the strength of my exchange interaction. Okay. Now, this one is simpler to understand by taking what is called the diabatic approximation, where you imagine the electron to be in the, the alpha, beta here are the two different potential wells. Okay, and then when the electron moves from the potential well alpha to potential well beta, its hopping amplitude is multiplied by the overlap of the nuclear wave function. That is the well-known Frank Condon factor. Okay, but that in this case it overestimates that value. Okay, now so if you take that, now you can compute your isotope effect, because the isotope effect changes the things by changing your delta. Okay, and you find that your J for the oxygen mass of 14, 15, 16 to 20 the J is reduced, and you can extract an isotope exponent which is comparable to what you find in the experiment. I guess maybe I should just stop here. Let me just put a summary slide. So studied the effects of the bivalent interaction in the manganites, and we get the parameters and the static Jahn-Teller coupling effect. It modifies the adiabatic potential surface, leads to the specific type of orbital ordering, and then the exchange interactions can be all understood in terms of a simple model if you take the orbital ordering into account, which is produced by the Jahn-Teller effect, and then the dynamical Jahn-Teller coupling effect that produces a reduction in the J, and it leads to an isotope effect. Thanks.
So now, is it something like Polaron effect or what is it?
Polaron effect?
This isotope effect.
No, in this model, all that is changed is the J. The J is modified by the fact that the oxygen has to move with with the electron.
Why? Is it because of Polaron effect then narrowing of the
No, 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 no. No, I mean, why, no, it's the Jahn-Teller effect. See, the thing is,
okay, Jahn-Teller, say J is where over U. What happens?
No.
He changes, what, how I mean.
You missed that point. Okay. The important thing is that when the electron, see, if you have D4, you have a distortion. Agree?
Okay.
When you have D3, you have no distortion. Right? So now when the electron goes from one side to another, it has a tendency to carry that distortion along with it. Okay. So therefore
the
Well, yeah, but it's in a more localized case, yeah.
So is it exponential?
I mean, when you think of the polaron, it's actually more like you are thinking of a delocalized picture. So the picture I gave you is a more localized picture.
No,
so, but... What reduction factor? Okay, I go
with
that.
I've been just trying to understand the. I don't have an understanding of the following fact, which is that in many of these systems, which are nominally metallic and ferromagnetic, the low temperature resistivities are very large, and of course these are not very clean systems. But that's the point. I mean, no matter how disordered the system is, the low temperature resistivity. If the carrier density is reasonable, is expected to be of the order of a milliohm centimeter or so. That is the Mott limit. And in many of these systems, the Mott limit is violated by several orders of magnitude. So such a thing is not known anywhere else in any other system. I mean, violations of Mott limit by 2 minutes are over?
No,
it may be two-phase, but even in two-phase, to have such a wide variation of resistivity is not possible. I mean, you can think of a percolation model. Sure, but then in a percolation, then you have to arrange things in a particular way so that this happens. Because, you know, percolation, unless you are very close to the percolation limit, the resistivity will not be very large. So it has to be, somehow there has to be a conspiracy so that you are always exponentially close to the percolation limit. Well, I mean, that you have to understand why it is very large. But I think even more interestingly, the resistivity depends in a very specific way on the magnetization, and that's what is shown here. You see, on the saturation magnetization, now that is not quite, I mean, this is something else, you see. I mean, this is nothing to do with percolation. No, but it's exponentially dependent on the magnetization. So why should it depend exponentially on magnetization if, you know, there is some, you know, if it is near the let me put it this way. You see, if the system is near some percolation threshold, unless you put it extremely close to this percolation threshold, the resistivities of this order are very difficult to get. By whom? By how? Well, I would like to discuss it. Yeah. I mean,
okay, so, I mean, basically you can do that. You can do percolation analysis. So x minus xt and there's some power. Okay.
Yeah.
Like, you know, x minus xt, or some percolation threshold, and there's some power. The power is at large.
But why is it large?
Power is like a four.
But I mean, how do we know otherwise? Do we know? Do you have any other evidence to believe that it is near a percolation threshold?
I mean, all this,
okay, but I do find two things not quite consistent with this possibility. One is that this resistivity has a systematic dependence on the magnetization. That is, we measure in the same system the magnetization at zero temperature and measure the resistivity. So this is a whole family of systems in which strontium is the divalent ion and the other ions are the magnetic ions. And you notice that there is an exponential dependence here as well as in these two. Now, this, I don't know whether this can be made consistent with the idea that you are near a percolation threshold, because magnetization depends very gently on, the magnetization would also depend on x minus xc with some sort of exponent of this kind, right? So then there would not be any exponential dependence of this kind. So, you know, this, I find it, okay, I mean, it, maybe there is a percolation explanation, but then this correlation I find hard to believe. Similar connection between the resistivity and the magnetization has been obtained in cleaner systems by other people. I mean, you can just take the resistivity as measured and at different temperatures and look at the magnetization at those temperatures. And instead of plotting resistivity as a function of temperature, you plot the resistivity as a function of equilibrium magnetization, and you get a similar correlation. So those are not systems which are near any percolation threshold. See, those are very clean systems. Yes, take a manganite and take the resistivity at different temperatures, the ferromagnetic manganite, and this resistivity, instead of plotting it as a function of temperature, you plot it as a function of magnetization at that temperature. Yeah. Then you get a similar curve. So all this suggests to me that there is something else which is happening, which we don't understand. All right. I mean, now you have to say that the cleanest films or three-dimensional systems, they are inhomogeneous percolating systems.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Static.
Static.
Okay. Well, all right.
At optimal doping.
At optimal doping.
No, 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 no.
Right, right. Well, that...
I mean, I should show you the paper. I mean, the first thing that has been carefully analyzed is all published in Nature, sometimes.